A Theban pair has been chosen by Nicodemus, the stepson, second in command. A high honor. He and Lysis will join the hunt tonight. Most of Charon's pairs have been detailed to the countryside, with stepsons monitoring them. Nowhere that trouble could find them. As if they were raw recruits. Tracking down and killing a young fighter is inharmonious, onerous, and sad. Nevertheless, this quarry is dangerous, the risk very real. And the mission is honorable in the eyes of the sacred band of stepsons. Honorable battle sustains a sacred band. He cannot deny his son, Lysis, this chance to face a worthy foe. Perhaps if Shamshi had had an older, wiser partner, as was the Theban custom, tragedy could have been averted. But things are as they are. One door closes, another opens. The band is closing the door on Shamshi, said to be a warlock's bastard son, and opening it wide for his Lysis, blessed by Harmony herself. Charon believes very little in sorcery, which, to his mind, is the realm of superstitious women, fools, the infirm, and the very old. He believes very much in the gods, in blessed Harmony, in the fates, and in his own good fortune at having been snatched, son and all, from the jaws of death. If Lysis's mother in far Elysian could see them now, how happy she would be to have her son accepted, like his father, among these strangers, even into the exalted company of the band's leadership. Charon resolved to make the most of these opportunities brought to him by Harmony. To show his gratitude, he played her three songs before the little altar in his room where he'd placed her statuette. One hymn to her, a paean to joy itself, and a love song fit for such a lovely day. Since it meant so much to Artan, Nico agreed to let the boys go by the bazaar on the way to Aphrodisia House. To get there from the barracks north of town, they had to enter the city through Triumph Gate, which meant riding south down General's Road, through the caravan grounds, and north again to the Street of Red Lanterns. The young fighters and the Theban leader were Nico's bait to flush Shamshi from hiding. If Shamshi was about, seeing these would surely lure him. Parading Lysis, Artan, Chorus, and Charon through town was not the worst of plans. The west side was a good place for confrontation from horseback, if it came tonight. The farmer's market and caravan grounds are relatively open spaces. The bazaar and the Red Lantern district are more built up, more claustrophobic, and more dangerous. Nevertheless, the west side has fewer ramshackle buildings jumbled close than does the maze. Sanctuary's chock-a-block slum, which lords its notoriety over the alleyways of Downwind and Shambles Cross and Ratfall, decrepitude, more tumble-down and treacherous yet. Fewer alleys meant fewer rickety roosts and dilapidated hidey-holes for a sniper. If Nico had been Shamshi, he would have fled. Be miles away now in another town, another city, another land. But Nico was not Shamshi, and Nico could feel the wizard boy nearby, his bleak intention, the slither of a stalker, the occasional rattle in Nico's rest place as Shamshi reconnoitered Nico's mental battlements. He doubted that Shamshi could assault him there and win, but with this adversary, even that was on the table. Spears thunking into flesh, men staggering back, impaled, whimpering. The battle plane of Chaeronea flashes through his mind too much, day and night, or is it the battle plane in Shamshi's rest place? Unless the pairs out hunting Sham caught him in the open and got very, very lucky, this renegade could wreak his vengeance on all and sundry for as long as he wished. The wizard boy might hide out in the maze indefinitely or slide deeper into sanctuary's bowels, into downwind or shambles or ratfall, where none might ever find him. With Sham's Bandaran skills, the renegade could track the trainee's progress, might have touched their minds by now. It remained to use Karen and the youths to make Shamshi come to Nico. So it mattered little whether Nico herded his lambs through the streets or penned them up inside Aphrodisia House. When Shamshi was ready, when the lure was irresistible, he would come. The hunted would become the hunter. Nico hadn't taken Karen into his confidence. Though Karen might guess, he must know nothing more than did the three young fighters. The plan was plausible. The bait must remain unknowing, lest Shamshi catch wind of the trap from the boy's thoughts or Karen's. Shamshi will sense no deception when truth is truth. And the boys, as well as Karen, needed this outing in the face of so much change, so much portent, so much suddenly right, and so much suddenly wrong, all at once. Theban goddess come to sanctuary, wizard boy on the rampage. By the time they got to the Zidanzo's little fortune-telling shop and tied their horses there, night was settling, sunset fading. The bazaar was a warren of crooked streets, flimsy stands, illicit caravanners and fly-by-night dealers, where the desperate and predatory slipped out of the nearby slums by night. "Tell my fortune, old woman." Perhaps he'd ask her, perhaps not. Nico had all the prophecy he needed when he looked at the Riddler and saw vigor returning with the strength of the storm god close at hand. Outside the poor little shop with its two torches lit to beat back the night, he stroked his mare and gave Karen some coppers to pay the seeress for the boy's fortunes. "I'll stay here with the horses. You go inside. But make it brief." Now that they were here, in this indefensible position, the back of Nico's neck was a prickle. But even if Sham pounced, Bandaran training or not, he was only one man. Shadows were legion, lengthening, merging on the dirty streets. "Stealth, you're sure?" said Karen, avuncular with his son close by. "Quite sure. My fortune is in my commander's hands, and so is yours." Karen followed the young fighters up the steps. They knocked. The door to the fortune-teller's shop opened. Light spilled around a heavy woman's figure, out onto the half-rotted steps. If this woman could see the future, then why couldn't she improve her own lot?
"We won't be long," Karen promised from the Sedanzo's doorway and disappeared inside. The door closed with a squeak and Nico had a moment to himself. He'd had few such moments lately for calm and reflection. Wanted none. He promised the Riddler he'd find Shamshi and kill him if he could. So Nico had chosen these young fighters to recreate the circumstances at Aphrodisia House. To attract his quarry. Long days, sleepless nights when so many men hunt down a youth to kill him. The commander would join the vigil by and by. Since the god and goddess met on the jetty, Tempus had been growing stronger and Nico more ill at ease. Some read the appearance of the deities on the beach as sanctification. Nico remembers the Theban goddess cautioning him. You, fighter, adept of mind, avatar of Enlil in name but not in soul, take care, or lose all you've won at such great cost. The meaning of her warning remains unclear. Show me what you mean, I don't understand. But maybe he does. He needs to help Tempus. He's won nothing but a chance to put things right after Chironea. Wants nothing else. Things are out of balance, teetering toward a collapse Nico can see but not define. Unpredictable elements are colliding, wills careening into one another. Enlil, this foreign goddess, Shamshi, the wizard boy, the necromant, the seer, the storm god's son, predestined Thebans saved from death or from angry fates. Who knew but that another hunt was underway in the country of the gods? One thing, weighed against all, could balance the scales. The Riddler, regaining his former mettle. His chest wound is nearly healed. No one would have said it when the commander seemed so threatened, but now Crit and Strat admit how deeply they'd been worried. And Tempus is better, if not yet all he was before. Before the spear that Nico couldn't block, that he wasn't fast enough to deflect. Before the sickening thud, long spear thunking into flesh. He can't forgive himself, can't get past it. He's begun to shun sleep the way his commander does. But Nicodemus, unlike Tempus, must sleep sometime. If he sleeps, he might dream. In his dreams, he might be vulnerable to so many unfettered forces here. To the necromant, to the dream lord, whose smithery he wears tonight upon his person. Even to Shamshi, who rattles the gates of his rest place. He must chase Chironea from his mind and retake control. Tempus has forgiven him. He must forgive himself. He scratches absently at recent Chironean flesh wounds, pulling layers of dead skin away from freshly minted battle scars on both arms and on his thigh. He talked softly to his sable mare, nonsense and endearments. She was calm, placid, and probably pregnant by now. The mating had quelled her heat as it was meant to do. He was musing about the foal to come when he heard a step, then another, behind him. Still stroking his mare, he looked over his shoulder. A young woman stood there, modestly cloaked in the flickery torchlight of this mild summer night, which should not hold so much portent or so much risk. She said, "What a lovely mare!" Her head was bare, her hair spilled into her hood. Her face was beautiful, innocent. But Nico had been snared by beauty and innocence more than once. The Riddler had warned him to beware here. So had the Theban goddess. He wished he had waited for Tempus, but the trap was his to set, the Riddlers to spring. He had his orders. "Thank you," he said carefully. Her soft eyes caught the torchlight and held it.
"What is this horse's name?"
She came closer, toward the mare. Nico said, "She doesn't have one. She's an Ascalonian. There aren't many. In the whole band, there's not another like her." Despite himself, his muscles tensed as this woman came up out of nowhere. Was this a witch in comely guise, coalescing out of shadow to kill him? Shamshi in disguise? He didn't think so.
"An Ascalonian mare, from the land of dreams. My, my, I can well believe it. What a lucky man you are,"
she said, and came closer still. Her voice was musical.
"But you should name her."
She walked up to the horse, her hands clasped behind her. The mare raised its head. Before Nico could warn her that this was a warhorse, the young woman leaned forward, hands still clasped behind her back, and breathed into the mare's nostrils. The mare blew softly and then nickered. The woman stepped back. She was a lady, this one. Not a witch, not a trollop, despite being on the street by herself so late.
"It was good to see her," she said. "And you. Stepson, isn't it?"
"Stealth," called Nicodemus.
He couldn't stop looking at her. So brave. So sure a woman coming up to a strange horse and exchanging breath.
"You shouldn't be out alone so late," he said, hoping she would stay. "What's your name?"
"Me? If your mare needs no name, why do I? And I am safe, never fear."
"Wait, and I'll see you to your door."
He didn't want to lose track of her, not yet. But then the boys were on the Sedanzo's threshold, coming out, talking and laughing, Karen behind them. All five horses milled about. He had to quiet them. When he looked up, she was gone. He was unreasonably disappointed. She was a chance-met noblewoman, found and lost in an instant, who wouldn't even give her name to a lowly stepson. No matter. He had a trap to bait, a renegade to run to ground, and, with luck, a battle to join. At Aphrodisia House, once the horses were safe in the stable out back, they found the salon crowded with locals who'd grown accustomed to the band standing around, watchful and heavily armed. Every burgundy couch and seat was taken. When he saw Karen's eyebrow raise at painted women and boys with coal and seashell dust around their eyes, Nico said, "It's time for Lysis to learn. He's surely old enough." "We don't do it this way in Thebes."
"How do you do it in Thebes?"
"In Thebes? A boy of good breeding would be mentored by an aristocrat in war and love, in music and philosophy, to tame his fierce nature. Normally my son would have had such a sacred band partner, not his father, to teach him all of these and more and buy his panoply when he came of age. But Lysis is my youngest. His mother is in Elysium. I've kept him with me." Karen was disapproving. He waved a hand at folk nuzzling one another, drinking, laughing on the plush couches and the stairs. "When it was time for women, they would be invited to the sponsor's house after a celebration or a battle.
or there would be a temple virgin, or an arranged marriage with property and dowry that needed sons to hold it firm.
I'll station him outside the door to watch the street, Nico offered. Looking beyond Karen's head, where Kouris, who should be checking exits, was talking to a girl who looked familiar.
No, let it be. He'll learn new ways here. So will I.
Outside, distant thunder rumbles low as Kouris sees Nico, waves and comes over, a young harlot under his arm.
Stealth called Nicodemus, favorite of the Riddler, of the sacred band of stepsons, says Kouris. This is Shami. Shami, this is the... my commander's right-side partner.
Nico inclines his head to her, the son of Vashanka, the local storm god, treating a whore like a lady.
Molin Torchholder would not be pleased, Nico said. Young woman, have you a problem? Can I help?
The girl looked at him through Rankin blue eyes. There was a northern bloodline in her. She said,
kind sir, Kouris said I should tell you.
Tell me what?
He was covertly scanning the crowd, looking for anything out of place, watching Artin and Lysis talking to people and moving through groups as they should.
I remember, Shami said, when I found it on the downwind beach. When the stepsons were here last time, I was just a young girl starting to work here to get out of Ratfall.
She held out a silvery tube, the length of her hand, which had a flat compartment along one side.
This is for you. A mage named Randall told me to give it to the band if you ever came back. It surmounts evil, he told me. Keeps doom at bay.
Randall.
Now Nico was paying attention. His former partner, Randall, was in Lemuria these days. Taking the tube she proffered, he pulled back the slide on the compartment. There were darts inside that had been in there for a long time. Darts such as these were invariably poisoned.
Thank you, Shami. That was, what, 10 years ago or more?
People here aged dependably, not like in Lemuria, where time stood still. Shami couldn't have been more than 11 or 12 when she'd found it, from the look of her now.
And thank you, Kouris, for bringing this to me. Citizens shouldn't have dangerous toys, he said formally, cautioning.
He tucked the tube into his belt.
It was a long time ago, Shami said wistfully, when I lived here in Aphrodisia House.
She has her own house now,
Kouris said defensively. Outside, lightning flickered, more thunder rumbled, closer now.
Don't you, Shami?
Her hair was black tonight. Had it been black before?
She only works here as a favor to the madam on special nights.
This isn't one of those special nights, Kouris, so far as you're concerned. You're on duty. Get back to it. Careful, Kouris, of this harlot bearing a gift and a mage's message, both a decade old. He turns away. To end the audience, and here are Tempest, Stratton, and Critias, blowing in the door on a wet wind, gusting. One look at his commander's face tells Nico something has happened that Tempest doesn't like. Rain, beaded on their mantles, drips down onto the floor. Patrons scatter as the stepsons clear the bar and order drinks. Karen and the trainees forgotten. Nico threads through the crowd, which disperses like skittering leaves. His senses fan out, showing him agitated colors dancing around Tempus, Critias, and Stratton, red, yellow, white. He meets them at the bar, sliding into the space on Tempus's right. The Riddler says,
"Order something,"
through tight lips. Nico does. All the stepsons, drinks in hand, turn to watch the room.
"What's happened?"
he asks, nearly in the Riddler's ear. He'd been expecting something like black wings coming closer, rustling overhead these last days. Without looking away from the couches and the tables, Tempus answers,
"Sink's team found Ari and the Theban pair, dead and stripped in the uplands near the Redfall River. Horses gone. Killed with their own weapons, crossbow bolts and throwing stars. Very sloppy. We should be able to find the horses at least, dead or alive, if we can't find Shamshi."
The Riddler is enraged, barely whispering.
"Corpses were discolored, stiff," Crit adds, matter of fact.
"Stinking," Strat says.
"Bellies badly bloated. 2-3 days old. We started looking for them when they didn't check in with anyone."
Strat is fairly growling. Anger radiates from Tempus like physical heat, making Nico start to sweat. This means pyres tomorrow, funerary rites, both stepson and Theban, and all the gloom and disorientation that comes with them. Karen spies them and heads their way, cutting through the crowd like a trireme on the attack. Now they must tell Karen that two of his are dead, probably at the hands of the renegade stepson.
"First blood,"
Nico says softly, squeezing his eyes shut for a moment, struggling to remain impassive. "Ari." Nico had known Ari since the Ticey campaign.
"But not last," Tempus promises.
"Look what Chorus found on one of the whores here." Nico pulls out the dart tube with its poisoned darts and shows it to Tempus. "She's had it for 10 years. Randall told her to hold it for us if we returned."
"Randall," the Riddler shakes his head. "Just what we don't need here, a wizard weapon."
"Commander, what would wizards want with poison? Sorcery doesn't work here now, according to Torch. Even if it was a wizard weapon once, that poison's so old it's probably lost its power," Crit says sensibly.
"Let's hope we haven't lost ours." The Riddler's gaze now fixes on Chorus, who is studying everything from one corner of the room, arms at his sides, ready and waiting. Tempus rubs his jaw.
"Give the dart tube back to Chorus. Maybe then the rain will stop."
When they went outside to get the horses, the rain had stopped, and Nico's sable mare was gone.
End of chapter 14.
Chapter 15. Gods and Heroes.
"Look at them,"
Lysis says to Chorus as the pyre burns low and men drift away toward the barracks to mourn or drink or ride out to their duty. 3 fighters dead, 2 Thebans, Dianikes and Clydon, 1 stepson, Ari. For the first time, Abarsis, the stepson's patron shade, took all 3 fallen fighters away on smoke and flame, soul by precious soul. Tonight's ceremony was more a stepson ritual than Theban, yet all of neither, some of both. New rites for a new and greater sacred band. Thebans wander about, awed but uneasy, not knowing whether their brothers are bound for far Elysion or some other rest. Pipes sound softly in the twilight, an old Theban hymn to the dead. The oncoming night is lucent with memories.
"Just look at them," says Lysis again.
"Look at who?" Chorus asks. He has Shawmy's dart tube in his belt pouch. It feels cool to the touch. Chorus doesn't really care what Lysis has to say. Ari is with Abarsis and the Storm God in heaven. Their stepson, Ari, had died protecting those two Thebans from Sham, probably. But not certainly. Long spears thunking into flesh. So much dying and grieving. Damned Thebans. Who are you talking about? The Riddler and Stealth. Look at them.
Last gleam of firelight, first rays of starlight play on ceremonial panoplies as Tempest and Nico, with Stratton and Critias alongside, go to get their horses in the coming dark.
I'm looking. So what? They're not coming this way. They have better things to do. Find Stealth's horse, for one.
Insult added to injury, that the horse of the band's second in command was stolen.
Those two, they're like Odysseus and Diomedes on the night hunt.
Lysis says admiringly in a muted tone.
They're like the heroes of the Iliad, with their swift-footed horses swaggering off to battle as the gods decree.
Like who?
Lysis, get a grip. Hero worship will get you killed, and they're not swaggering. They're in a hurry.
Lysis might be blessed by Harmony and have his father, leader of the Thebans, watching over him here, but Sanctuary is Storm God territory as far as Chorus is concerned. Chorus is angry at the Thebans, at anything Theban. He must be careful. Death always makes him want to kill something in return. Stepsons met the band's leaders with four prancing horses. The Riddler's two silver trose horses, Crit's chestnut, and the bay ghost horse. The two pairs mounted, reined around, and all four thundered away into the night toward the city, mantles billowing out behind them. Above, the sky goes from dark blue to blue-black. Stars will be bright tonight with the fat moon rising, unhidden by clouds.
Let's find Artan. Report to Sink and go. Your father's not coming, Lysis. Sink's leading with Gale until we get to town, then we've got our own patrol. Hurry or we'll be late.
They were posted to the maze tonight, their first patrol of Sanctuary's infamous slum. Gale had assigned Chorus a big dun from the stepson's string. He didn't usually get so good a horse. The stallion is a handful, busy testing Chorus as to who is who and which of them, horse or rider, is in control. His legs were already aching. The dun wants convincing. Chorus is grateful for the dark. At least Sink and Gale, up ahead, don't see him struggle. All the horses were reassigned tonight because the mare was missing. Maybe Sink will let Chorus stop by Aphrodisia House to see Shawmy when his shift is done. He sighed past the dun over to Arton's gelding and had to kick hard to get it done. Stratton rode this horse when he wasn't on the ghost horse. Like rider, like horse.
The Dun is as stubborn and immune to coercion as the big interrogator. They were near the white foal split when the first arrow whispered over Kouris's head. Then a second nearly struck the Dun. Kouris could hear the air rushing to get out of the crossbow bolt's way. The arrow seemed slow to him, as if he could grab it in flight, just reach out and grasp it while it pushed air against his face going by his nose. In one motion, Sink wheeled his horse and fired a bolt, cursing. Gale swung his mount around on Sink's right, swearing and shooting almost in unison. Kouris shot back down the trajectory of the last incoming bolt, aiming where he thought the shooter was hiding, and knocked another bolt. He couldn't see their assailant. Lysis fired next, crouching low on his horse's neck. Then a quarrel from this hidden enemy hit Lysis in the thigh, and the Theban cried out. Sliding off his horse, buttocks to mount, Kouris was already aiming his crossbow when Sink called the dismount code. Lysis, pinned by the thigh to his saddle, fumbled for another quarrel and swept the dark with his crossbow's snout before he shot back. Sink fired again, then Gale did, then Kouris did. Kouris had never heard so clearly in battle. Hooves pounding dirt, girths squeaking, metal jingling, men cursing, labored breathing, grunts and whistles, short swords rasping from scabbards, crossbows firing. Reactions of the others seemed so slow to him, orders from his patrol leader superfluous. Kouris doesn't care about Sink's orders now. He can hardly hear Sink or Gale above the blood pounding in his ears. There's a shooter out there somewhere. He stands behind his horse, its reins under his foot, and shoots over its saddle, aiming where he thinks the quarrels are coming from, cranking his crossbow, and cranks and levers and shoots again and again, moving with his mount as it sidles left and right. Everyone is shooting, even Lysis. Crossbow bolts whisper by. Kouris strains his eyes to catch a glimpse of their attacker. A gleam, a telltale sign. Some flash of panoply. Some movement in the dappled night. Not enough moonlight yet, but almost, almost. His heart is beating faster. He can almost see, almost feel the other shooter, almost find the enemy in the dark. He knocks one more quarrel, fires one more bolt into the trees across the road. His horse jigs, jostling his hand on the trigger. The shot goes wild.
"That's enough," Sink decrees. "Hold your fire."
Kouris doesn't. Gale shouts,
"Hold your porking fire, everybody. Kouris, darling, that means you too."
Kouris doesn't see Lysis at first, in the dark, but he hears him. Lysis is chattering, shocky. His voice is shaky, high and full of bravado. As the moon finally begins to rise, Gale swears at the quarrel in Lysis's thigh.
"Porking arrows, porking well stuck in the saddle. Hold still, Lysis, I'm going to break it off."
Lysis yelps.
"Let me go after him."
Kouris implores the knight, feeling like a guard dog on too short a leash.
"The god will help me. He's running, can't you hear him? In the underbrush? I think I hit him. I know I can find him."
"Don't argue with me, stepson,"
Sink barks, in no mood for suggestions.
"Follow orders, boy."
"I said, that's enough.
We stay together. Get these horses off the road, down in the gully there, where there's cover. I need to see how bad this wound is."
So they will be pinned down here half the night, waiting for someone who wasn't here to shoot at them. Mount in tow, Artan comes over to Chorus, eye whites bright in the moonlight, saying breathlessly,
"See, my mother said. Three of swords reversed. Blood and conflict. Death card upside down. Danger."
"Bull's balls upside down. Danger? Facing danger is our job, Hawk.
It's easy to predict trouble when there's a renegade stepson out here picking us off and everybody knows it."
Chorus snaps. He feels invincible, feels like the storm god himself, full of wrath and hungry for a target. Something to kill. He has a grievance to redress.
"Shoot at me? Beware, Sham, the wrath of the storm god and his son."
Above their heads, the sky clouds over completely where before the night was utterly clear. Lightning flares, revealing everything around them, bright as day. Thunder peals, lightning strikes and strikes again so fast the thunder can't keep up, and when thunderclaps come rolling, they sound like remonstrance from heaven. The ground beneath them shakes and quivers. Horses rear and paw the sky, then plunge, blaring. In the bright white flashes of lightning, Chorus can see blood streaming from Lysis's thigh, the bolt buried so deep in flesh that it goes right through, and the broken shaft sticks out the other side. Thunder roars and roars and roars again. Rain deluges them as they scramble with their spooky horses down into the gully by the road. Lysis's arm is over Gale's shoulder, both of them one easy target now. Lysis can't walk, unaided. Chorus has to take Lysis's horse, which is terrified and neighing all the way. Lightning cracks the sky and thunder shakes the ground once more. Now there's a whipping wind to drive the rain, to clean the wound on Lysis's skewered leg. The storm god's rain, soaking them all to the skin. And Chorus thinks, "Too late, father. Leave off with thy lightning. Our enemy has fled. You're scaring all the horses." Does Vashanka really hear him? It seems so, but he's never known for certain. And god or no god, he was stuck here, by Sink's order, in a muddy ditch. With Gale swearing a blue streak, with Artan marveling that his vision came true, with Lysis going shocky and incoherent, and with all the frightened horses, milling and neighing. No matter what the storm god wanted, there'd be no more chasing after this enemy tonight. Maybe Chorus's bolt had sped true, but there'd be no telling. Any blood trail would be washed away by the torrential rain falling.
"Sham, you better run."
End of chapter 15. Chapter 16, Gift of Heaven. Nico hadn't gone back to the barracks with Tempest when the weather finally broke. Another long night of searching sanctuary had turned up no trace of Nico's sable mare. The mare was no one else's responsibility. He had lost her, he must find her, not take up the band's time searching for one horse. He felt invaded, violated, singled out, and too angry for his mat to help him. He needed to check the horse trader's stalls. He was praying she might be there, or anywhere. If she were dead, there wasn't enough room in hell for the thief to hide from him. But he didn't think she was dead. His mare should have come back when he called her. If she were anywhere near, she would have. He had gone to his rest place and called her. He'd looked out through her eyes. He could see a stall around her, but nothing to tell him where that stall was, or if he was really sensing her alive and well, or just wishing he was. He was riding one of Tempest's Tros stallions, a big dapple gray like all the Tros breds. Perhaps one of the best horses in the world, kill-trained and experienced beyond what most horses ever learned. On the day of the funerary rites for Ari and the Theban pair, Tempest had been so kind, so understanding. The Riddler had brought out the Tros, tacked up and ready, and handed him its reins without a word. He shouldn't have this horse, invaluable to the band, since he'd lost them, the Ascalonian mare. He'd said that. Tempest just clapped him on the shoulder, saying, "We'll find a Nico," and went back into the barn. Dawn was breaking, the maze coming to life. The byways were clean for once, washed by the downpour. Men and women swept their storefronts' debris out into the streets, maintaining the standard of the neighborhood. He rode by the Vulgar Unicorn, wondering if anyone he'd known was still there. The few he'd recognized on the streets looked so much older, and they looked at him as if they'd seen a ghost. No one aged in Lemuria, and he'd spent 5 years in the Eternal City at the edge of time as well. So these folk all looked a decade older, and he hadn't changed, except for a few more scars here and there. He rode west toward the farmer's market, out by the caravan grounds, near the White Foal River. When he got there, every horseman who saw the Tros stared unabashedly. There were at least a dozen traders leading stock back and forth before prospective buyers. He slid off the Tros and strolled, reins in hand, over to the nearest horse trader, squat and jowly with greasy skin and black spots on his face. "You want to sell that horse, soldier?" said the trader in a Nisi accent. "Give you a good price. Not much of that blood around except up in Free Nisibis, and they don't sell the ones they's got." At least there was still a Free Nisibis. Nico had fought in the war to make it so. Those Nisi Bisi horses were kin to his, from when the stepsons had a stock farm there. "He's not for sale." Three other traders had been edging close. They heard the answer to the question everyone wanted to ask, and moved away, back to their canvas stalls. "I'm looking for a mare."
"A mare for him? I'll show you the best I've got, but I don't think you'll want her."
The best horses were always stabled closest to the town. "Not for him. The mare I'm looking for has light brown eyes with black flecks, a black stripe down her spine, and black dapples on a gold bay coat. Sable-colored, big, very strong, seen her?" The man hadn't. You could dye a hair coat any color, though, so Nico had to look at every big mare in the market. He didn't find her, and the Tros kept collecting admirers. People trailed the horse to see what the mercenary with the gray stallion had in mind. When he gave up and left, he was satisfied she wasn't in the farmer's market. Heading back to the barracks, he rode north on General's Road, under a sky that was blue overhead and fighting valiantly to withstand storm clouds blowing inland. There was one thing he hadn't tried. He could ask the Dream Lord, his mare's breeder, for help. To do that, he'd need to find Ascalon in his dreams or use his transcendent perception. But he wasn't calm enough, and he didn't have time to sleep, let alone dream. Not yet. He was hoping the long ride would soothe him, the stallion single-footed along. Birds chirped and butterflies flitted. Rabbits hopped in the grass to the east where, beyond, a few farms lay. Wheat and hay fields waved in the sun. He was just thinking he hadn't realized there were so many farms out this way when he heard another horse approaching from his left. Overhead, a red-tailed hawk circled, then flew leftward, its shadow in his path. Right to left, overhead, was the best of bird omina. The Tros didn't break gait, but gave an ear-splitting welcome to a horse coming from a side road where bushes and trees grew tall. The oncoming horse whinnied, a high-pitched cry. He knew that whinny like he knew his own heartbeat. His pulse raced. Wait. And then there was his sable mare, a woman in leathers astride her. The rider's long honey hair flowed freely down her back. His mare, her tipped-in ears pointing his way, started to trot toward him. Wait. He almost drew his short sword. He loosened it in its scabbard. Then he halted the Tros, one hand on his hilt, while horse and rider came his way. His pulse slowed. His heartbeat steadied. He was acutely aware of everything around him. The wind on his face brought him the smells of meadow and hayfields nearby. Birds fluttered among the trees. Bushes bowed in the breeze along the roadside as the horse and woman approached. Wait. Wait. Until she had closed the distance between them, until his mare and the Tros stood nearly nose to nose. "That's my horse you've got there," he said flatly.
"I know, stepson," said the woman.
"Your mare with no name. She turned up in my backyard yesterday morning. Since no one came to claim her, I thought to ride out to your barracks to return her."
"No need," he said. "I'll take her."
This was the young noblewoman he'd met outside Illyra's fortune-telling shop in the bazaar. She was even more beautiful than he remembered, but it had been dark that night, with torchlight flickering.
"It's a long ride back to your barracks," Stealth called Nicodemus. "Come to my house and give your grey some water first. It's right down this path."
Somehow there seemed no harm. She was correct. Tempest's grey would like a drink. Deserved one before the lengthy ride into the uplands. His anger had been replaced with relief. He had found his mare. The woman motioned him to come along, so he followed her, keeping his stallion behind the mare's swishing tail. The woman sat her horse well. They rode up a sheltered path around a bend to a house with columns, white and hidden from the road. He'd had no idea that such a house was back here, but he'd been away a long time. A servant came unbidden to take their horses and water them. Sliding off the Tros, he loosened his horse's girth and handed over its reins. Before he let the man take his mare, he touched her all over. There was no heat in her hooves, her pasterns, her knees, or her hocks. She seemed unharmed. She whickered and butted him with her head.
Come inside, Stealth called Nicodemus. Have some water yourself. Wait out the heat of the day.
Thank you, he said. It would be impolite to refuse.
Inside, all was cool and airy, filled with diffuse light. She disappeared and reappeared, bringing water, wine, and fruit for them. You should eat something. The sound of her voice made it seem so. He ate some fruit while she watched. We shall celebrate the reunion of two loved ones. She moved like a dancer with a fascinating grace. Here, let me take your things.
He held on to his weapons, saying, I won't be here long.
Of course you won't, she said, coming up to him so close that they nearly touched. She put her hand on his sword belt. He knew he should back away, get his horses, and ride out of there. Right now. I need to go. He didn't make a move. She didn't take her hand away. He knew where this was going, but he couldn't find the resolve to stop it. I have responsibilities. Of course you do.
This isn't his first gymkhana, not the first time he's been waylaid, but for some reason he doesn't know what to say or do this time. Her hand is still on his belt, just resting there, not asking or demanding anything. He doesn't make a move to touch her, unwilling in any way to force the issue. He is just a fighter. She is some noble lady. He can't risk being thought forward, misreading her, or displeasing her. She smells like meadow, like new-mown hay and morning sun. By now he isn't thinking of anything but her eyes, her innocent face, her smooth skin and honey hair down to her hips.
Come, child of balance, you have all the time you need.
He is undone in a heartbeat, drowning in those wide, soft eyes. Her fingers unbuckle his sword belt. All the while, she holds his eyes with hers, never blinking. It is impossible to resist her. There is no reason even to try.
Stand still, she says.
She runs her hands over him, caressing him here and there and everywhere. His skin flares hot wherever her fingers slide along him. He hasn't felt such a touch in years. He hasn't let down his guard so far in forever and a day. Somehow, she was behind him and before him and he was naked. Her fingers found the grievous scars on his groin, on his buttocks, and he felt more sensation there than he had for so very long.
She says, What's this? All these wounds.
He says, I got those winning. It is what he always says on the few occasions anyone sees those scars and dares to ask about them. She says,
You've won a lot, then.
As never before, he feels he must explain. So he does. I'm a son of the armies. Priests did some of that to me. Politics, some. Some I got for no good reason. I have a calling to restore balance. When balance is restored, people get hurt. Her sweet eyes seem about to spill tears. He doesn't want that. He picks her up and kisses her eyelids. It's all right, he says. She is light as a feather, her honey-colored hair brushing his chest, his arms, tickling his skin, his groin and his thighs.
He carries her upstairs to a bed as soft as clouds, in a room painted like the skies above. He is spinning joyously out of control by then. He goes where she leads him, does what she tells him, and never once thinks of anything but this.